and race for home before the Valentines descend upon us. Victorian was no craven, but no more was he a fool. He could not defeat 300 ships with 54. She'll be my wife, and you will be her maid. A maid without a tongue could never let slip any secrets. He might have said more, but that was when the maester came, rapping at the cabin door, as timid as a mouse. "Enter," Victorian called out, "and bar the door. You know why you're here?"
"Lord Captain."
The maester looked like a mouse as well, with his grey robes and little brown moustachio. "Does he think that makes him look more manly?" Kerwin was his name. He was very young, 22 maybe.
"May I see your hand?" he asked.
A fool's question. Maesters had their uses, but Victorian had nothing but contempt for this Kerwin, with his smooth pink cheeks, soft hands and brown curls. He looked more girlish than most girls. When first he came aboard the Iron Victory, he had a smirky little smile, too. But one night off the Stepstones, he had smiled at the wrong man, and Burton Humble had knocked out 4 of his teeth. Not long after that, Kerwin had come creeping to the captain to complain that 4 of the crew had dragged him below decks and used him as a woman. "Here is how you put an end to that," Victorian had told him, slamming a dagger down on the table between them. Kerwin took the blade, too afraid to refuse it, the captain judged, but he had never used it. "My hand is here," Victorian said. "Look all you like." Maester Kerwin went down to one knee, the better to inspect the wound. He even sniffed at it like a dog.
"I will need to let out the pus again. The colour, Lord Captain, the cut is not healing. It may be that I will need to take your hand."
They had talked of this before. "If you take my hand, I will kill you. But first I will tie you over the rail and make the crew a gift of your arse. Now get on with it."
"There will be pain."
"Always."
"Life is pain, you fool. There is no joy but in the drowned guard's watery halls.
Do it." The boy, it was hard to think of one so soft and pink as a man, laid the edge of the dagger across the captain's palm and slashed. The pus that burst forth was thick and yellow as sour milk. The dusky woman wrinkled her nose at the smell. The maester gagged, and even Victorian himself felt his stomach churn. "Cut deeper. Get it all. Show me the blood." Maester Kerwin pressed the dagger deep. This time it hurt, but blood welled up as well as pus, blood so dark that it looked black in the lantern light. Blood was good. Victorian grunted in approval. He sat there unflinching as the maester dabbed and squeezed and cleaned the pus away with squares of soft cloth boiled in vinegar. By the time he'd finished, the clean water in his basin had become a scummy soup. The sight alone would sicken any man. "Take that filth and go." Victorian nodded at the dusky woman. "She can bind me up." Even after the boy had fled, the stink remained. Of late there was no escaping it. The maester had suggested that the wound might best be drained up on deck amidst fresh air and sunlight, but Victorian forbade it. This was not something that his crew could see. They were half a world away from home, too far to let them see that their iron captain had begun to rust. His left hand still throbbed, a dull pain, but persistent. When he closed his hand into a fist, it sharpened, as if a knife was stabbing up his arm. "Not a knife, a longsword. A longsword in the hand of a ghost." Sari, that had been his name, a knight and heir to South Shield. "I killed him, but he stabs at me from beyond the grave, from the hot heart of whatever hell I sent him to. He thrusts his steel into my hand and twists." Victorian remembered the fight as if it had been yesterday.
His shield had been in shards, hanging useless from his arm, so when Ceres' longsword came flashing down, he had reached up and caught it. The stripling had been stronger than he looked. His blade bit through the lobster steel of the captain's gauntlet and the padded glove beneath into the meat of his palm. A scratch from a little kitten, Victorian told himself afterwards. He had washed the cut, poured some boiled vinegar over it, bound it up, and thought little more of it, trusting that the pain would fade and the hand heal itself in time. Instead, the wound had festered, until Victorian began to wonder whether Ceres' blade had been poisoned. Why else would the cut refuse to heal? The thought made him rage. No true man killed with poison. At Moat Cailin, the bug devils had loosed poison arrows at his men, but that was to be expected from such degraded creatures. Ceres had been a knight, high-born. Poison was for cravens, women, and Dornishmen. "If not Ceri, who?" he asked the dusky woman. "Could that mouse of a maester be doing this? Maesters know spells and other tricks. He might be using one to poison me, hoping I will let him cut my hand off." The more he thought on it, the more likely it seemed. "The crow's eye gave him to me, wretched creature that he is." Euron had taken Kerwin off Greenshield, where he had been in service to Lord Chester, tending his ravens and teaching his children, or perhaps the other way around. And how the mouse had squealed when one of Euron's mutes delivered him aboard the Iron Victory, dragging him along by the convenient chain about his neck. "If this is his revenge, he wrongs me. It was Euron who insisted he be taken, to keep him from making mischief with his birds." His brother had given him 3 cages of ravens, too, so Kerwin could send back word of their voyaging, but Victorian had forbidden him to loose them. "Let the crow's eye stew and wander." The dusky woman was binding his hand with fresh linen, wrapping it 6 times around his palm, when Long Water Pike came pounding at the cabin door to tell him that the captain of Grief had come aboard with a prisoner. "Says he's brought us a wizard, Captain. Says he fished him from the sea." A wizard? Could the drowned god have sent a gift to him? Here, on the far side of the world? His brother Aaron would have known. But Aaron had seen the majesty of the drowned god's watery halls below the sea before being returned to life. Victorian had a healthy fear of his god, as all men should, but put his faith in steel. He flexed his wounded hand, grimacing, then pulled his glove on and rose. "Show me this wizard." Grief's master awaited them on deck, a small man, as hairy as he was homely. He was a spar by birth. His men called him the Vole.
"Lord Captain," he said, when Victorian appeared, "this is Makaro, a gift to us from the drowned god."
The wizard was a monster of a man, as tall as Victorian himself and twice as wide, with a belly like a boulder and a tangle of bone-white hair that grew about his face like a lion's mane. His skin was black, not the nut-brown of the summer islanders on their swan ships, nor the red-brown of the Dothraki horse lords, nor the charcoal and earth colour of the dusky woman's skin, but black, blacker than coal, blacker than jet, blacker than a raven's wing. Burned, Victorian thought, like a man who has been roasted in the flames until his flesh chars and crisps and falls smoking from his bones. The fires that had charred him still danced across his cheeks and forehead, where his eyes peered out from amongst a mask of frozen flames. "Slave tattoos," the captain knew, "marks of evil."
"We found him clinging to a broken spar," said the Vole. "He was 10 days in the water after his ship went down.
If he were 10 days in the water, he'd be dead, or mad from drinking seawater." Salt water was holy,
Aaron Dampier and other priests might bless men with it and swallow a mouthful or two from time to time to strengthen their faith, but no mortal man could drink of the deep sea for days at a time and hope to live.
"You claim to be a sorcerer?" Victorian asked the prisoner.
"No, Captain,"
the black man answered in the common tongue. His voice was so deep it seemed to come from the bottom of the sea.
"I am but a humble slave of R'hllor, the Lord of Light."
"R'hllor, a red priest, then?"
Victorian had seen such men in foreign cities, tending their sacred fires. Those had worn rich red robes of silken and velvet and lamb's wool. This one was dressed in faded, salt-stained rags that clung to his thick legs and hung about his torso in tatters. But when the captain peered at the rags more closely, it did appear as if they might once have been red.
"A pink priest,"
Victorian announced.
"A demon priest," said Wolf One Ear. He spat.
"Might be his robes caught fire, so he jumped overboard to put them out,"
suggested Longwater Pike, to general laughter. Even the monkeys were amused. They chattered overhead, and one flung down a handful of his own shit to spatter on the boards. Victorian Greyjoy mistrusted laughter. The sound of it always left him with the uneasy feeling that he was the butt of some jape he did not understand. Euron Crozeye had oft made mock of him when they were boys. So had Aaron, before he had become the Dampier. Their mockery oft came disguised as praise, and sometimes Victorian had not even realized he was being mocked. Not until he heard the laughter. Then came the anger, boiling up in the back of his throat, until he was like to choke upon the taste. That was how he felt about the monkeys. Their antics never brought so much as a smile to the captain's face, though his crew would roar and hoot and whistle.
"Send him down to the drowned god before he brings a curse upon us," urged Burton Humble.
"A ship gone down, and only him clinging to the wreckage," said Wolf One Ear.
"Where's the crew? Did he call down demons to devour them? What happened to this ship?"
"A storm."
Makaro crossed his arms against his chest. He did not appear frightened, though all around him men were calling for his death. Even the monkeys did not seem to like this wizard. They leapt from line to line overhead, screaming. Victorian was uncertain.
"He came out of the sea. Why would the drowned guard cast him up, unless he meant for us to find him?"
His brother Euron had his pet wizards. Perhaps a drowned god meant for Victorian to have one too.
"Why do you say this man is a wizard?" he asked of Vol. "I see only a ragged red priest."
"I thought the same, Lord Captain. But he knows things. He knew that we made for Slaver's Bay before any man could tell him. And he knew you would be here, off this island."
The small man hesitated.
"Lord Captain, he told me you would surely die, unless we brought him to you."
"That I would die?"
Victorian snorted.
"Cut his throat and throw him in the sea," he was about to say, until the throb of pain in his bad hand went stabbing up his arm almost to the elbow. The agony so intense that his words turned to bile in his throat. He stumbled and seized the rail to keep from falling.
"The sorceress cursed the captain," a voice said.
Other men took up the cry.
"Cut his throat, kill him, before he calls his demons down on us."
Longwater Pike was the first to draw his dirk.
"No," Victorian bellowed. "Stand back, all of you. Pike, put up your steel. Vol, back to your ship, Humble. Take the wizard to my cabin. The rest of you, about your duties."
For half a heartbeat, he was not certain they would obey. They stood about muttering, half with blades to hand, each looking to the others for resolve. Monkey shit rained down around them all. Splat, splat, splat. No one moved, until Victorian seized the sorcerer by the arm
and pulled him to the hatchway. As he opened the door to the captain's cabin, the dusky woman turned toward him, silent and smiling. But when she saw the red priest at his side, her lips drew back from her teeth, and she hissed in sudden fury, like a snake. Victorian gave her the back of his good hand and knocked her to the deck. "Be quiet, woman. Wine for both of us." He turned to the black man. "Did the vole speak true? You saw my death?"
"That and more."
"Where? When? Will I die in battle?" His good hand opened and closed. "If you lie to me, I will split your head open like a melon and let the monkeys eat your brains."
"Your death is with us now, my lord. Give me your hand."
"My hand? What do you know of my hand?"
"I have seen you in the night fires, Victorian Greyjoy. You come striding through the flames, stern and fierce, your great axe dripping blood, blind to the tentacles that grasp at your wrist and neck and ankle, the black strings that make you dance."
"Dance?" Victorian bristled. "Your night fires lie. I was not made for dancing, and I'm no man's puppet." He yanked off his glove and shoved his bad hand at the priest's face. "Here, is this what you wanted?" The new linen was already discolored by blood and pus. "He had a rose on his shield, the man who gave this to me. I scratched my hand on a thorn."
"Even smallest scratch can prove mortal, Lord Captain. But if you will allow me, I will heal this. I will need a blade. Silver would be best, but iron will serve. A brazier as well. I must needs light a fire. There will be pain, terrible pain, such as you have never known. But when we are done, your hand will be returned to you."
"They're all the same, these magic men. The mouse warned me of pain as well. I am ironborn, priest. I laugh at pain. You will have what you require, but if you fail, and my hand is not healed, I will cut your throat myself and give you to the sea."
Makaro bowed, his dark eyes shining.
"So be it."
The Iron Captain was not seen again that day, but as the hours passed, the crew of his Iron Victory reported hearing the sound of wild laughter coming from the captain's cabin, laughter deep and dark and mad, and when Longwater Pike and Wolf One Eye tried the cabin door, they found it barred. Later, singing was heard, a strange high wailing song, in a tongue the maester said was High Valyrian. That was when the monkeys left the ship, screeching as they leapt into the water. Come sunset, as the sea turned black as ink and the swollen sun tinted the sky a deep and bloody red, Victorian came back on deck. He was naked from the waist up, his left arm blood to the elbow. As his crew gathered, whispering and trading glances, he raised a charred and blackened hand. Wisps of dark smoke rose from his fingers as he pointed at the maester.
"That one, cut his throat and throw him in the sea, and the winds will favour us all the way to Meereen."
Makaro had seen that in his fires. He had seen the wench wed too. But what of it? She would not be the first woman, Victorian Greyjoy, had made a widow. Theon. The sky was a gloom of cloud, the woods dead and frozen. Roots grabbed at Theon's feet as he ran, and bare branches lashed his face, leaving thin stripes of blood across his cheeks. He crashed through, heedless, breathless, icicles flying to pieces before him. "Mercy," he sobbed. From behind came a shuddering howl that curdled his blood. "Mercy! Mercy!" When he glanced back over his shoulder,
he saw them coming, great wolves, the size of horses, with the heads of small children.
Oh, mercy, mercy!
Blood dripped from their mouths, black as pitch, burning holes in the snow where it fell. Every stride brought them closer. Theon tried to run faster, but his legs would not obey. The trees all had faces, and they were laughing at him, laughing, and the howl came again. He could smell the hot breath of the beast behind him, a stinking brimstone and corruption.
They're dead! Dead! I saw them killed!
He tried to shout. I saw the reds dipped in tar! But when he opened his mouth, only a moan emerged, and then something touched him, and he whirled, shouting. Flailing for the dagger he kept by his bedside, he managed only to knock it to the floor. Wex danced away from him. Reek stood behind the mute, his face lit from below by the candle he carried.
"What?" Theon cried. "Mercy! What do you want? Why are you in my bedchamber? Why?"
"My lord, prince," said Reek, "your sister's come to Winterfell. You asked to be informed at once if she arrived."
"Past time," Theon muttered, pushing his fingers through his hair. He had begun to fear that Asher meant to leave him to his fate.
"Mercy."
He glanced outside the window, where the first vague light of dawn was just brushing the towers of Winterfell. "Where is she?"
"Lauren took her and her men to the Great Hall to break their fast. Will you see her now?"
"Yes." Theon pushed off the blankets. The fire had burned down to embers. "Wex, hot water." He could not let Asher see him, dishevelled and soaked with sweat.
Wolves were children's faces. He shivered. "Close the shutters."
The bedchamber felt as cold as the dream forest had been. All his dreams had been cold of late, and each one more hideous than the one before. Last night he had dreamt himself back in the mill again, on his knees, dressing the dead. Their limbs were already stiffening, so they seemed to resist sullenly as he fumbled at them with half-frozen fingers, tugging up breeches and knotting laces, yanking fur-trimmed boots over hard, unbending feet, buckling a studded leather belt around a waist no bigger than the span of his hands. "This was never what I wanted," he told them as he worked. "They gave me no choice." The corpses made no answer, but only grew colder and heavier. The night before, it had been the miller's wife. Theon had forgotten her name, but he remembered her body, soft, pillowy breasts and stretch marks on her belly, the way she clawed his back when he fucked her. Last night in his dream, he had been in bed with her once again, but this time she had teeth above and below, and she tore at his throat even as she was gnawing off his manhood. It was madness. He'd seen her die too. Gelmer had cut her down with one blow of his axe as she cried to Theon for mercy.
"Leave me, woman. It was him who killed you. Not me. And he's dead as well."
At least Gelmar did not haunt Theon's sleep. The dream had receded by the time Wex returned with the water. Theon washed the sweat and sleep from his body and took his own good time dressing. Asher had let him wait long enough. Now it was her turn. He chose a satin tunic striped black and gold and a fine leather jerkin with silver studs, and only then remembered that his wretched sister put more stock in blades than beauty. Cursing, he tore off the clothes and dressed again, in felted black wool and ringmail. Around his waist he buckled sword and dagger, remembering the night she had humiliated him at his own father's table.
"A sweet suckling babe, yes. Well, I have a knife too, and know how to use it."
Last of all he donned his crown, a band of cold iron slim as a finger, set with heavy chunks of black diamond and nuggets of gold. It was misshapen and ugly, but there was no help for that. Mickon lay buried in the lich yard, and the new smith was capable of little more than nails and horseshoes. Theon consoled himself with the reminder that it was only a prince's crown. He would have something much finer when he was crowned king. Outside his door, Reek waited with Erzin and Crom. Theon fell in with them. These days he took guards with him everywhere he went, even to the privy. Winterfell wanted him dead. The very night they had returned from Acorn Water, Gelmar the Grim had tumbled down some steps and broken his back. The next day, Aegar turned up with his throat slit ear to ear. Jinnah Redrose became so wary that he shunned wine, took to sleeping in Burnie, Quaff and Helm, and adopted the noisiest dog in the kennels to give him some warning should anyone try to steal up on his sleeping place. All the same, one morning the castle woke to the sound of the little dog barking wildly. They found the pup racing around the well, and Red-Nose, floating in it, drowned. He could not let the killings go unpunished. Farland was as likely a suspect as any. So Theon sat in judgment, called him guilty, and condemned him to death. Even that went sour. As he knelt to the block, the kennel master said, "My Lord Eddard always did his own killings." Theon had to take the axe himself, or look a weakling. His hands were sweating, so the shaft twisted in his grip as he swung, and the first blow landed between Farland's shoulders. It took three more cuts to hack through all the bone and muscle and sever the head from the body. And afterwards, he was sick, remembering all the times they'd sat over a cup of mead talking of hounds and hunting. "I had no choice," he wanted to scream at the corpse. "The Ironborn can't keep secrets. They had to die, and someone had to take the blame for it." He only wished he had killed him cleaner. Ned Stark had never needed more than a single blow to take a man's head. The killing stopped after Farland's death, but even so, his men continued sullen and anxious. "They fear no foe in open battle," Black Loren told him. "But it's another thing to dwell among enemies, never knowing if the washerwoman means to kiss you or kill you, and whether your servant boy is filling your cup with ale or bale. We would do well to leave this place." "I am the Prince of Winterfell," Theon has shouted. "This is my seat. No man will drive me from it. No, nor woman either."
"Asha, it was her doing. My own sweet sister.
May the others bugger her with a sword." She wanted him dead so she could steal his place as their father's heir. That was why she had let him languish here, ignoring the urgent commands he had sent her. He found her in the high seat of the Starks, ripping a capon apart with her fingers. The hall rang with the voices of her men, sharing stories with Theon's own as they drank together. They were so loud that his entrance went all but unnoticed. "Where are the rest?" he demanded of Reek. There were no more than 50 men at the trestle tables, most of them his. Winterfell's great hall could have seated 10 times that number.
"This is the whole of the company, my lord prince."
"The whole? How many men did she bring?"
20 by my count."
Theon Greyjoy strode to where his sister was sprawled. Asha was laughing at something one of her men had said, but broke off at his approach.
"Why, 'tis the Prince of Winterfell."
She tossed a bone to one of the dogs, sniffing about the hall. Under that hawk's beak of a nose, her wide mouth twisted in a mocking grin.
"Or is it Prince of Fools?"
"Envy ill becomes a maid." Asha sucked grease from her fingers. A lock of black hair fell across her eyes. Her men were shouting for bread and bacon. They made a great deal of noise, as few as they were.
"Envy, Theon?
What else would you call it? With 30 men, I captured Winterfell in a night. You needed 1,000 and a moon's turn to take Deepwood Mott."
"Well, I'm no great warrior like you, brother." She quaffed half a horn of ale and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. "I saw the heads above your gates. Tell me true, which one gave you the fiercest fight? The cripple or the babe?"
Theon could feel the blood rushing to his face. He took no joy from those heads, no more than he had in displaying the headless bodies of the children before the castle. Old Nan stood with her soft, toothless mouth opening and closing soundlessly, and Farland threw himself at Theon, snarling like one of his hounds. Erzin and Cadwell had to beat him senseless with the butts of their spears. "How did I come to this?" he remembered thinking, as he stood over the fly-speckled bodies. Only Maester Lewin had the stomach to come near. Stone-faced, the small grey man had begged leave to sew their boys' heads back onto their shoulders, so they might be laid in the crypts below with the other Stark dead. "No," Theon had told him, "not the crypts."
"But why, my lord? Surely they cannot harm you now. It is where they belong. All the bones of the Starks."
"I said no." He needed the heads for the wall, but he had burned the headless bodies that very day in all their finery. Afterward, he had knelt amongst the bones and ashes to retrieve a slag of melted silver and cracked jet, all that remained of the wolf's head brooch that had once been Bran's. He had it still. "I treated Bran and Rickon generously," he told his sister. "They brought their fate on themselves. As do we all, little brother." His patience was at an end. "How do you expect me to hold Winterfell if you bring me only 20 men?"
10, Asher corrected. "The others return with me. You wouldn't want your own sweet sister to brave the dangers of the wood without an escort, would you? There are dire wolves prowling the dark."
She uncoiled from the great stone seat and rose to her feet.
"Come, let us go somewhere we can speak more privily."
She was right, he knew, though it galled him that she would make that decision. "I should never have come to the hall," he realized belatedly. "I should have summoned her to me." It was too late for that now, however. Theon had no choice but to lead Asher to Ned Stark's solar. There, before the ashes of a dead fire, he blurted, "Dagmar's lost the fight at Torrhen Square."
"The old Castellan broke his shield wall, yes," Asher said calmly. "What did you expect? This Sir Roderick knows the land intimately, as the Cleftjaw does not, and many of the Northmen were mounted. The Ironborn lack the discipline to stand a charge of armored horse. Dagmar lives. Be grateful for that much. He's leading the survivors back toward the stony shore."
"She knows more than I do," Theon realized. That only made him angrier. "The victory has given Leobald Tallheart the courage to come out from behind his walls and join Sir Roderick. And I've had reports that Lord Manderley has sent a dozen barges upriver packed with knights, war horses, and siege engines. The Umbers are gathering beyond the last river as well. I'll have an army at my gates before the moon turns, and you bring me only 10 men?"
"I need not have brought you any."
"I commanded you."
"Father commanded me to take Deepwood Mutt," she snapped. "He said nothing of me having to rescue my little brother."
"Bugger Deepwood," he said. "It's a wooden pisspot on a hill. Winterfell is the heart of the land, but how am I to hold it without a garrison?"
"You might have thought of that before you took it. Oh, it was cleverly done, I'll grant you. If only you had the good sense to raise the castle and carry the two little princelings back to Pike as hostages, you might have won the war in a stroke."
"You'd like that, wouldn't you? To see my prize reduced to ruins and ashes."
"Your prize will be the doom of you. Krakens rise from the sea, Theon. Or did you forget that during your years among the wolves? Our strength is in our longships. My wooden pisspot sits close enough to the sea for supplies and fresh men to reach me whenever they are needful. But Winterfell is hundreds of leagues inland, ringed by woods, hills, and hostile holdfasts and castles, and every man in 1,000 leagues is your enemy now, make no mistake. You made certain of that when you mounted those heads on your gatehouse."
Asher shook her head.
"How could you be such a bloody fool? Children!"
"They defied me," he shouted in her face. "And it was blood for blood, besides. 2 sons of Eddard Stark to pay for Roderick and Maron." The words tumbled out heedlessly, but Theon knew at once that his father would approve.
I've laid my brother's ghost to rest. Our brothers, Asher reminded him with a half-smile that suggested she took his talk of vengeance well salted.
Did you bring their ghosts from Pike, brother? And here I thought they haunted only father.
When has a maid ever understood a man's need for revenge? Even if his father did not appreciate the gift of Winterfell, he must approve of Theon avenging his brothers. Asher snorted back a laugh.
This, Sir Roderick, may well feel the same manly need. Did you think of that? You are blood of my blood, Theon, whatever else she may be. For the sake of the mother who bore us both, return to Deepwood Mott with me. Put Winterfell to the torch, and fall back while you still can.
No, Theon adjusted his crown. I took this castle, and I mean to hold it. His sister looked at him a long time.
Then hold it you shall, she said, for the rest of your life.
She sighed.
I say it tastes like folly, but what would a shy maid know of such things?
At the door she gave him one last mocking smile.
You ought to know that's the ugliest crown I've ever laid eyes on. Did you make it yourself?
She left him fuming and lingered no longer than was needful to feed and water her horses. Half the men she'd brought returned with her as threatened, riding out the same hunter's gate that Bran and Rickon had used for their escape. Theon watched them go from atop the wall. As his sister vanished into the mists of the Wolf's Wood, he found himself wondering why he had not listened and gone with her.
Gone, is she?
Reek was at his elbow. Theon had not heard him approach, nor smelled him either. He could not think of anyone he wanted to see less. It made him uneasy to see the man walking around breathing with what he knew. I should have had him killed after he did the others, he reflected, but the notion made him nervous. Unlikely as it seemed, Reek could read and write, and he was possessed of enough base cunning to have hidden an account of what they'd done.
My lord prince, if you'll pardon me saying, it's not right for her to abandon you. And 10 men, that won't be near enough.
I'm well aware of that, Theon said. So was Asher.
Well, might be I could help you, said Reek. Give me a horse and a bag of coin, and I could find you some good fellows.
Theon narrowed his eyes. How many?
100, might be. 200, maybe more.
He smiled, his pale eyes glinting.
I was born up north here. I know many a man, and many a man knows Reek.
200 men were not an army, but you didn't need thousands to hold a castle as strong as Winterfell. So long as they could learn which end of a spear did the killing, they might make all the difference.
Do as you say, and you'll not find me ungrateful. You can name your own reward. Well, my lord, I haven't had no woman since I was with Lord Ramsay, Reek said. I've had my eye on that parlour, and I hear she's already been had, so,
He'd gone too far with Reek to turn back now. 200 men, and she's yours, but a man less, and you can go back to fucking pigs. Reek was gone before the sun went down, carrying a bag of stark silver and the last of Theon's hopes. Like as not, I'll never see the wretch again, he thought bitterly, but even so, the chance had to be taken. That night, he dreamed of the feast Ned Stark had thrown when King Robert came to Winterfell. The hall rang with music and laughter, though the cold winds were rising outside. At first it was all wine and roast meat, and Theon was making japes and eyeing the serving girls and having himself a fine time, until he noticed that the room was growing darker. The music did not seem so jolly then. He heard discords and strange silences, and notes that hung in the air, bleeding. Suddenly the wine turned bitter in his mouth, and when he looked up from his cup, he saw that he was dining with the dead. King Robert sat with his guts spilling out on the table from the great gash in his belly, and Lord Eddard was headless beside him. Corpses lined the benches below, grey-brown flesh sloughing off their bones as they raise their cups to toast. Worms crawling in and out of the holes that were their eyes. He knew them, every one. Jory Cassell and Fat Tom, Porther and Kane, and Hullen, the master of horse, and all the others who had ridden south to King's Landing, never to return. Micken and Shale sat together, one dripping blood and the other water. Benfred Tallheart and his wild hares filled most of a table. The miller's wife was there as well, and Farlan, even the wildling Theon had killed in the Wolf's Wood the day he had saved Bran's life. But there were others with faces he had never known in life, faces he had seen only in stone. The slim, sad girl who wore a crown of pale blue roses and a white gown spattered with gore could only be Lyanna. Her brother, Brandon, stood beside her, and their father, Lord Rickard, just behind. Along the walls, figures half seen moved through the shadows, pale shades with long, grim faces. The sight of them sent fear shivering through Theon sharp as a knife. And then the tall doors opened with a crash, and a freezing gale blew down the hall, and Rob came walking out of the night. Grey wind stalked beside, eyes burning, and man and wolf alike bled from half a hundred savage wounds. Theon woke with a scream, startling Weck so badly that the boy ran naked from the room. When his guards burst in with drawn swords, he ordered them to bring him the maester. By the time Lewin arrived, rumpled and sleepy, a cup of wine had steadied Theon's hands, and he was feeling ashamed of his panic. "A dream," he muttered. "That was all it was. It meant nothing." "Nothing," Lewin agreed solemnly. He left a sleeping draught, but Theon poured it down the privy shaft the moment he was gone. Lewin was a man as well as a maester, and the man had no love for him. "He wants me to sleep, yes, to sleep and never wake. He'd like that as much as Asher would." He sent for Kyra, kicked shut the door, climbed on top of her, and fucked the wench with a fury he'd never known was in him. By the time he finished, she was sobbing, her neck and breast covered with bruises and bite marks. Theon shoved her from the bed and threw her a blanket. "Get out!" Yet even then, he could not sleep. Come dawn, he dressed and went outside to walk along the outer walls. A brisk autumn wind was swirling through the battlements. It reddened his cheeks and stung his eyes. He watched the forest go from grey to green below him as light filtered through the silent trees. On his left, he could see tower tops above the inner wall, their roofs gilded by the rising sun. The red leaves of the weirwood were a blaze of flame among the green. "Ned Stark's tree," he thought, "and Stark's wood, Stark's castle, Stark's sword, Stark's gods. This is their place, not mine. I am a Greyjoy of Pike, born to paint a kraken on my shield and sail the great salt sea. I should have gone with Asher." On their iron spikes atop the gatehouse, the heads waited. Theon gazed at them silently while the wind tugged on his cloak with small, ghostly hands. The miller's boys had been of an age with Bran and Rickon, alike in size and colouring, and once reek had flayed the skin from their faces and dipped their heads in tar, it was easy to see familiar features in those misshapen lumps of rotting flesh. People were such fools. If we'd said they were ram's heads, they would have seen horns. Tyrion. Chella, daughter of Cheek of the Black Ears, had gone ahead to scout, and it was she who brought back word of the army at the crossroads.
"By their fires, I called them 20,000 strong," she said. "Their banners are red, with a golden lane."
"Your father?" Bronn asked.
"Oh, my brother, Jamie," Tyrion said, "we shall know soon enough." He surveyed his ragged band of brigands. Near 300 Stone Crows, Moon Brothers, Black Ears, and Burn Men, and those just the seed of the army he hoped to grow. Gunthor, son of Gurn, was raising the other clans even now. He wondered what his lord father would make of them, in their skins and bits of stolen steel. If truth be told, he did not know what to make of them himself. Was he their commander or their captive? Most of the time, it seemed to be a little of both.
"It might be best if I rode down alone," he suggested. "Best for Tyrion, son of Tywin," said Ulf, who spoke for the Moon Brothers.
Shagger glowered, a fearsome sight to see.
"Shagger, son of Dolph, like this nut. Shagger will go with the boy man, and if the boy man lies, Shagger will chop off his manhood."
"And feed it to the goats, yes," Tyrion said wearily. "Shagger, I give you my word as a Lannister, I will return."
"Why should we trust your word?"
Chilla was a small, hard woman, flat as a boy and no fool.
"Lowland lords have lied to the clans before."
"You wound me, Chilla," Tyrion said.
"Here I thought we had become such good friends. But as you will. You shall ride with me, and Shagger and Conn for the Stone Crows, Ulf for the Moon Brothers, and Timmet, son of Timmet, for the Burn Men."
The clansmen exchange wary looks as he named them.
"The rest shall wait here until I send for you. Try not to kill and maim each other while I'm gone."
He put his heels to his horse and trotted off, giving them no choice but to follow or be left behind. Either was fine with him, so long as they did not sit down to talk for a day and a night. That was a trouble with the clans. They had an absurd notion that every man's voice should be heard in council, so they argued about everything endlessly. Even their women were allowed to speak. Small wonder that it had been hundreds of years since they had last threatened the Vale with anything beyond an occasional raid. Tyrion meant to change that. Bronn rode with him. Behind them, after a quick bit of grumbling, the five clansmen followed, on their undersized garrons, scrawny things that looked like ponies and scrambled up rock walls like goats. The Stone Crows rode together, and Chilla and Ulf stayed close as well, as the Moon Brothers and Black Ears had strong bonds between them. Timmet, son of Timmet, rode alone. Every clan in the Mountains of the Moon feared the Burned Men, who mortified their flesh with fire to prove their courage, and, the others said, roasted babies at their feasts. And even the other Burned Men feared Timmet, who had put out his own left eye with a white-hot knife when he'd reached the age of manhood. Tyrion gathered that it was more customary for a boy to burn off a nipple, a finger, or, if he was truly brave or truly mad, an ear. Timmet's fellow Burned Men were so awed by his choice of an eye that they promptly named him a Red Hand, which seemed to be some sort of war chief.
"I wonder what their king burned off," Tyrion said to Bronn when he heard the tale.
Grinning, the sellsword had tugged at his crutch. But even Bronn kept a respectful tongue around Timmet. If a man was mad enough to put out his own eye, he was unlikely to be gentle to his enemies. Distant watchers peered down from towers of unmortared stone as the party descended through the foothills, and once Tyrion saw a raven take wing. Where the high road twisted between two rocky outcrops, they came to the first strong point. A low earthen wall, 4 feet high, closed off the road, and a dozen crossbowmen manned the heights. Tyrion halted his followers, out of range, and rode to the wall alone.
"Who commands here?"
he shouted up. The captain was quick to appear, and even quicker to give them an escort when he recognized his lord's son. They trotted past blackened fields and burned holdfasts, down to the riverlands and the green fork of the Trident. Tyrion saw no bodies, but the air was full of ravens and carrion crows. There had been fighting here, and recently. Half a league from the crossroads, a barricade of sharpened stakes had been erected, manned by pikemen and archers. Behind the line, the camp spread out to the far distance. Thin fingers of smoke rose from hundreds of cook fires. Mailed men sat under trees and honed their blades, and familiar banners fluttered from staffs thrust into the muddy ground. A party of mounted horsemen rode forward to challenge them as they approached the stakes. The knight who led them wore silver armor inlaid with amethysts and a striped purple and silver cloak. His shield bore a unicorn sigil, and a spiral horn 2 feet long jutted out from the brow of his horse-head helm. Tyrion reined up to greet him. "Sir Flemont!" Sir Flemont Brax lifted his visor. "Tyrion," he said in astonishment, "my lord, we all feared you dead, or—" He looked at the clansman uncertainly. "These companions of yours?"
"Bosom friends and loyal retainers," Tyrion said. "Where will I find my lord father?"
"He has taken the inn at the crossroads for his quarters."
Tyrion laughed. "The inn at the crossroads. Perhaps the gods were just after all."
"I will see him at once." "As you say, my lord."
Sir Flemont wheeled his horse about and shouted commands. 3 rows of stakes were pulled from the ground to make a hole in the line. Tyrion led his party through. Lord Tywin's camp spread over leagues. Cheller's estimate of 20,000 men could not be far wrong. The common men camped out in the open, but the knights had thrown up tents, and some of the high lords had erected pavilions as large as houses. Tyrion spied the red ox of the Prestors, Lord Crakel's brindle boar, the burning tree of Marbrand, the badger of Lydon. Knights called out to him as he cantered past, and men-at-arms gaped at the clansmen in open astonishment. Shagger was gaping back. Beyond a certainty, he had never seen so many men, horses, and weapons in all his days. The rest of the mountain brigands did a better job of guarding their faces, but Tyrion had no doubts that they were full as much in awe. Better and better, the more impressed they were with the power of the Lannisters, the easier they would be to command. The inn and stables were much as he remembered, though little more than tumbled stones and blackened foundations remained where the rest of the village had stood. A gibbet had been erected in the yard, and the body that swung there was covered with ravens. At Tyrion's approach, they took to the air, squawking and flapping their black wings. He dismounted and glanced up at what remained of the corpse. The birds had eaten her lips and eyes and most of her cheeks, baring her stained red teeth in a hideous smile. "A room, a meal, and a flagon of wine? That was all I asked," he reminded her with a sigh of reproach. Boys emerged, hesitantly, from the stables to see to their horses. Shagger did not want to give his up.
"The lad won't steal your mare," Tyrion assured him. "He only wants to give her some oats and water and brush out her coat."
Shagger's coat could have used a good brushing too, but it would have been less than tactful to mention it.
"You have my word. The horse will not be harmed."
Glaring, Shagger let go of his grip on the reins.
"This is the horse of Shagger, son of Dolph,"
he roared at the stable boy.
"If he doesn't give her back, chop off his manhood and feed it to the goats,"
Tyrion promised.
"Providing you can find some."
A pair of house guards in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms stood under the inn sign on either side of the door. Tyrion recognized their captain.
My father?
In the common room, my lord.
My men will want meat and mead, Tyrion told them. See that they get it.
He entered the inn, and there was father. Tywin Lannister, lord of Castle Rock and warden of the West, was in his middle 50s, yet hard as a man of 20. Even seated, he was tall, with long legs, broad shoulders, a flat stomach. His thin arms were corded with muscle. When his once thick golden hair had begun to recede, he had commanded his barber to shave his head. Lord Tywin did not believe in half measures. He razored his lips and chin as well, but kept his side whiskers. Two great thickets of wiry golden hair that covered most of his cheeks from ear to jaw. His eyes were a pale green, flecked with gold. A fool, more foolish than most, had once jested that even Lord Tywin's shit was flecked with gold. Some said the man was still alive, deep in the bowels of Casterly Rock. Sir Kevin Lannister, his father's only surviving brother, was sharing a flagon of ale with Lord Tywin when Tyrion entered the common room. His uncle was portly and balding, with a close-cropped yellow beard that followed the line of his massive jaw. Sir Kevin saw him first. "Tyrion!" he said in surprise.
"Uncle," Tyrion said, bowing, "and my lord father, what a pleasure to find you here."
Lord Tywin did not stir from his chair, but he did give his dwarf son a long, searching look.
"I see that the rumours of your demise were unfounded."
"Sorry to disappoint you, father," Tyrion said.
"No need to leap up and embrace me. I wouldn't want you to strain yourself."
He crossed the room to their table, acutely conscious of the way his stunted legs made him waddle with every step. Whenever his father's eyes were on him, he became uncomfortably aware of all his deformities and shortcomings.
"Kind of you to go to war for me," he said, as he climbed into a chair and helped himself to a cup of his father's ale.
"By my lights, it was you who started this," Lord Tywin replied. "Your brother, Jaime, would never have meekly submitted to capture at the hands of a woman."
"That's one way we differ, Jaime and I. He's taller as well, you may have noticed."
His father ignored the sally.
"The honour of our house was at stake. I had no choice but to ride. No man sheds Lannister blood with impunity."
"Hear me roar,"
Tyrion said, grinning. The Lannister words.
"Truth be told, none of my blood was actually shed, although it was a close thing once or twice. Morak and Jick were killed."
"I suppose you'll be wanting some new men."
"Don't trouble yourself, father. I've acquired a few of my own."
He tried a swallow of the ale. It was brown and yeasty, so thick you could almost chew it. Very fine, in truth. A pity his father had hanged the innkeeper.
"How is your war going?"
His uncle answered, "Well enough for the nonce. Sir Edmure had scattered some troops of men along his borders to stop our raiding, and your lord father and I were able to destroy most of them piecemeal before they could regroup."
"Your brother has been covering himself with glory," his father said. "He smashed the lords Vance and Piper at the Golden Tooth, and met the massed powers of the Tullys under the walls of Riverrun. The lords of the Trident have been put to rout. Sir Edmure Tully was taken captive with many of his knights and bannermen. Lord Blackwood led a few survivors back to Riverrun, where Jaime has them under siege. The rest fled to their own strongholds."
"Your father and I have been marching on each in turn," Sir Kevin said. "With Lord Blackwood gone, Raventree fell at once, and Lady Went yielded Harrenhal for want of men to defend it.
Sir Gregor burnt out the papers and the Brackens, leaving you unopposed, Tyrion said. Not wholly, Sir Kevin said. The Malaster still holds Seagard, and Waldo